a volition that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given them, and by that volition they are choosing something which is evil, but the power ultimately belongs to Allah. So even whatever they are doing, it is by Allah's permission. And the reason why Allah permits is because of intense mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, it's only because of our ignorance of the realities that we don't know what is the hikmah of allowing such things to happen. You find that in the hereafter, some people would say, I wish these calamities would continue so that I can get even higher levels of perfection. And you, the for some people who, because of spiritual wayfaring, they come to a realization, even in this world, while they are going through spiritual exercises, they come to realize that there is wisdom in every action that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is doing. And therefore they don't question that.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So when a supplicant supplicates, and when he says that, he should understand that everything, all power belongs to Allah, and whatever happens to me, I cannot change the situation. In these two other phrases, whereby we say that whatever Allah opens cannot be closed, and whatever He closes cannot be opened, one of the probable meanings is that, you know, whatever door of mercy that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala opens, or for example, whatever outlet of difficulties or outlet from difficulties that Allah opens. Let's say you had a predicament that was actually strangulating you because of the problems that you are encountering. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala opens a way from that difficulty towards ease. And if He does that, however an enemy, you know, shows enmity to you, and whatever he plans against you, nothing would transpire, because Allah wants that you come out from your difficulties. And vice versa, if for example a person, you know, is in very much ease, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts him into difficulties because of the sins that he has committed, or because of a trial that he has to undergo so that he reaches a high level, and if somebody else wants him to come to the station of ease, nothing will happen, because ultimately Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has the control. The problem comes when a person relies on others and says, you know, this person will solve the situation, although the door has been closed apparently, but this person is going to solve the situation. Sometimes, you know, there is that ignorant expression that you find some people saying that, you know, because of Allah and because of this person, that is why I came out from the difficulties. Or, inshallah, Allah will help me and this person will help me. So, you know, it's as if he has considered two powers that exist: Allah's independent power and this person's independent power. Not realizing that this is shirk, this is actually trying to attribute somebody else the characteristics that Allah has. That means he actually thinks that there are two beings, but they are not two beings. The reality is that there is only one being. The other is an entity which depends on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He doesn't have anything of his own. Inshallah, we'll continue with our discussion in our next session. We come to the end of the program. والحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين.
That was the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
یا سجاد.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. And this is your host Ali Maytham. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is For Humanity. Well, we talked about establishing justice in the previous episodes. Now, when Islam talks about the protection of honor, the second important right is the right of citizen to protection of their honor. In the address delivered on the occasion of the farewell Hajj, to which I referred earlier, the enjoinment upon their honor, respect, and chastity was forbidden to one another. The Holy Quran clearly lays down, "You who believe, do not one set of people make fun of another set. A. B. Do not defame one another. C. Do not insult by using nicknames. D. Do not backbite or speak ill of one another." Chapter number 49, verse number from 11 to verse number 12. This is the law of Islam for the protection of honor, which is indeed much superior to one in the better in the Western law of defamation. According to Islamic law, it is proof that someone who attacks the honor of one person, then irrespective of fact, whether or not the victim is able to prove himself respectable and honorable person, the culprit will in any case get in due punishment. But the interesting fact about the Western law of defamation is that a person who files suit for defamation has to first prove that this man of honor and public esteem during the interrogation and is subject to scurrilous attack and accusation, and in dust of the dense concealed to such an extent that he earns more disgrace than the attack of his reputation, against which he had knocked the door of the court of law. On top of it, he has also produced such witness as would testify in the court that due to the defamatory accusation of the culprit, the accused stands disgraced in the eyes. Good glorious, what a suitable point of law, and what an adherence to the script of law. How can this unfair and just law be compared to the divine law? Islam declared blasphemy as a crime irrespective of the fact whether the accused man is the man of honor or not, whether the words used by blasphemy have actually disgraced the victim and harmed his reputation in the eyes of public or not. According to the Islamic law, mere proof of the fact that accused said things which according to common sense could have damaged the reputation and in honor of the plaintiff is enough for the accused to be declared guilty of defamation. Well, when we talk about the sanctity and security of private life, Islam recognizes the rights of every citizen in its states. There should be no undue interference or encroachment on privacy of his life. The Holy Quran has laid down to the unjust, "Do not spy on one another." Chapter number 49, verse number 12. Or when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Do not enter any house except your house unless you're sure of their occupant's consent." Verse number 27, chapter number 24. The Prophet ﷺ has gone to the extent of instructing his followers that a man should not enter even his own house suddenly or just like that. He should somehow or other inform the indicant to the dweller of the house that he's entering the house so that he may not see his mother, sister, and daughter in a condition which they would not like anyone to see, nor would himself like to see in that condition. Peering into the houses of another person has also strictly been forbidden. Allahu Akbar. The Prophet has also forbidden people from reading letters of others, so much so that if a person is reading his letter and another person casts side glance, and if he tries to read it, his conduct becomes irrespectable. This is the sanctity of privacy that Islam grants to individuals. Let's take a break now. We'll be right back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. We talked about the privacy that Islam gives to human beings. Where in the world do you see where other people, the ones who actually violate the human rights or abuse the human rights, talk about human rights? Where do you see that in the world? But Islam, on the other hand, in the modern civilized world, we can find the only letters of the other people are read and they're censored. But even the photocast copies are retained for future use or blackmail. Even bugging devices and secretly fixing the houses of the people so that he can hear and tape from a distance the conversation taking place behind closed doors. In other words, it's meant that there is no such thing as privacy to all the practical purposes, and the private life of an individual does not exist. The means of a fae spoil them is what the spies, CID or FBI agents are spread all around the country. Find out the affairs of men and the people being looked for one another was suspicious so much so that the people are afraid of talking freely in their houses. Let some words should escape from the lips of their wives and children may have put them in embarrassing situation. In this manner, it has become difficult for a common citizen to speak freely, even in his own house, and society begins to suffer from a state of general distrust and suspicion. This is the private life that you give. No wonder why there are people talking about it. If you Google about this guy who went to Russia, I can't remember his name, but it was Swoden, if I'm not wrong. Swoden, he escaped from America, and right now I'm not sure he's in Russia, and he openly declared that the FBI is spying on the people. The Facebook company is looking through your messages and all the probably the conversation that you might have had in the past, which are probably embarrassing if it come out in public. Well, guess what? They've already read in the Facebook department. So Islam has talked about the privacy, you know. You're not supposed to be spied, or, you know, it's kind of wrong to do that. Ethically, it's wrong. Well, when it comes to the topic of security of personal freedom, Islam has also laid down the principle that no citizen can be imprisoned unless his guilt has been proven into an open court to arrest the man only on the basis of suspicion, to throw him into a prison without a proper court proceeding and without providing him a reason, able opportunity to product his defense is not permissible in Islam. It is related in the hadith, once the Prophet was delivering a lecture in the mosque, when a man rose during the lecture and said, "O Prophet of God, for what crime have my neighbors been arrested?" The Prophet heard the question and continued his speech. The man rose once again and repeated the same question. The Prophet again did not answer and continued his speech. The man rose for the third time and repeated the same question. Then the Prophet ordered the man's neighbor to be released. The reason why the Prophet had kept quiet when the question was repeated twice earlier was the police officer was present in the mosque and there was proper reason for arrest of the neighbor of this man. He would have got up to explain his position. Since the police officer gave no reason for these arrests, the Prophet ordered the arrest in person should be released. The police officer was aware of the Islamic law and therefore he did not get up to say the administration is aware of the charges against the arrest man but they cannot be disclosed in public. If the Prophet would have inquired about this guilt in camera, I would have enlightened him. If the cop had made such statement, he would have been dismissed. Then there, the fact that the police officer did not give any reason for the arrest, the open court was sufficient reason for the Holy Prophet to give immediate order for the release of the arrest man. The injunction of the Holy Prophet is very clear on this point. Whenever you judge between people, you should judge with a sense of justice. Chapter number 4, verse number 58. So that is it for today. Don't forget to visit our website, which is www.parstoday.com, and click on the tab Call of Islam, where you can find our programs as well as this one. And you can email us and contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. With that being said, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
European News Bulletin.
I'm Saeed Puruza. An inquest into the controversial drowning of a Muslim school girl in the north of England has resumed. 12-year-old Shukri Avdi drowned in a river in Bury, Greater Manchester, in June 2019. It is alleged she was told by a child who was with her shortly before her death, "If you don't get into the water, I'm going to kill you." Campaigners have accused the authorities of not investigating the case properly because of institutional racism and Islamophobia. The case has become very prominent after it was highlighted by the Black Lives Matter movement and a number of black celebrities. Well, our correspondent Roshan Mohammed Saleh attended the court proceedings in Rochdale today, and here is his update.
So the inquest into the tragic drowning of 12-year-old Shukri Abdi has finally resumed after a nine-month delay caused by the COVID pandemic. Now, before lockdown, we heard harrowing testimony of how Shukri was coerced and threatened and bullied into the water before she drowned. Now, today, we've been hearing evidence from the child, who we can't name for legal reasons, who's accused of doing that bullying, threatening and coercing. And that child, who I'm going to call they said that they were friends with Shukri and that they tried their best to prevent her from drowning, but they couldn't. Now, this inquest is due to last for another 2 days, and we're going to hear more evidence from eyewitnesses. And after it finishes, the family is hoping for some closure at last. It's been an agonizing wait for the last 9 months for the family. As for the campaigners who have accused the authorities of institutional racism and Islamophobia, well, I guess they're hoping for the possibility of just saying that this case was finally investigated properly. Roshan Mohammed Saleh, Rochdale.
Mohsen Abbas is a political commentator joining me now with his perspective on that story. Good to have you with us, Mohsen. So without saying too much about the inquest proceedings, what do the broad strokes of this case tell us about how new arrivals to this country can be treated?
Well, I think the first thing is that there's a fallacy that Britain is great with the refugee sort of and asylum seekers. The fact is that over half of the people seeking asylum wait longer than 6 months for a decision. So traumatized people who are vulnerable are treated like this in the first place. They get about £5.66 a day and struggle to survive because they're banned from working. And again, vulnerable people rescued supposedly from war zones and other disrupted regions, usually by Western imperialism's kind of interventions. Let me hasten to add, Somalia being one of them. So, of course, first of all, you've got the context of these folk who are actually, supplemented with further, if you like, torture and violence, psychological torture at least. And add to this then the importance of this case in the sense of the issues of institutional Islamophobia, the environment of fear and hate that's been generated by Western media and the authorities themselves. And you also think about the bullying that goes on in these schools, and add to this the hasty conclusions initially of the police force, the whitewashing by the school itself, and you start seeing how, if you like, a culture of Islamophobia and hatred is actually affecting real lives of people who are already vulnerable, if you like.
Right. Speaking of that environment of fear and hate that you just mentioned, some of that happening online, some of the reactions to Shukri's mother, Zamzam, pressing for the truth of what happened to her child caused a social media storm, with some saying if she didn't like the handling of the case by the authorities, she could pack up and leave the country. Very disheartening.
Well, I think more than disheartening, it's a sign of the kind of attitude in certain sectors of British society which has now become the norm. Let's not underestimate the post 9/11 environment of hate and fear and how it's gripped certain communities, and that's all demonstrated within the rise of the right wing here and across Europe. It's demonstrated in, of course, Islamophobic hate crime, which is going through the roof. And the response of the authorities to such things, in this case, is a kind of significant. It signifies that there's a failure in the system. And I think what Ashley Underwood, the QC, has said is, in this case, is that essentially the lowest verdict expectation of a family is gross negligence or manslaughter, and they don't even rule out a verdict of murder. This is what they want. I mean, and this would be unthinkable given the actions of the institutions, the school itself and the police, had they not been pushed into this by this extraordinary grassroots campaign. So I think that justice and equality are at stake here, and certainly, if nothing else, this case has highlighted the fact that there is institutional racism, institutional Islamophobia, which is affecting real lives.
That the petition that gathered nearly a million signatures, all the emails that were sent to Andy Murray, the mayor of Greater Manchester, did definitely play a role in the resumption of the inquest. Mohsen Abbas, thank you very much. All right, the parents of a 19-year-old Briton killed in a road accident in 2019 have lost their court battle with the British government over the diplomatic immunity of the wife of a U.S. official responsible for the collision. Harry Dunn's family have said Anne Sakoulis was driving on the wrong side of the road when she crashed with a teenager who was riding a motorbike near an Air Force base used by the U.S. military. Sakoulis left Briton shortly after the accident. Her lawyer says she'll not return voluntarily to potentially face jail for a, quote, terrible but unintentional accident. She was charged with causing death by dangerous driving in December, but an extradition request was denied the following month. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has said the coming days will be decisive as the 27-member bloc seeks to clinch a trade deal with Britain after its departure from the European Union.
The European Union is well prepared for a no-deal scenario, but of course we prefer to have an agreement. I fully trust in the skillful steer of our chief negotiator, Michel Barnier. But one thing is clear. Whatever the outcome, there has to be, and there will be, a clear difference between being a full member of the Union and being just a valued partner.
All sides indicate they want a deal, but significant areas of disagreement persist. Rules over issues such as fair competition and fisheries have blocked progress for a number of months now. If no agreement is reached by December 31st, the two sides will trade according to the default rules set by the Geneva-based World Trade Organization, a scenario that will carry a significant financial impact. British Chancellor Rishi Sunak has announced he will borrow almost £400 billion this year to pay for the massive coronavirus hit to the UK's economy. The UK's economy is now set to shrink by more than 11% by the end of the year, its largest contraction since the early 1700s.
Our economic output is not expected to return to pre-crisis levels until the fourth quarter of 2022. And the economic damage is likely to be lasting. Long-term scarring means in 2025, the economy will be around 3% smaller than expected in the March budget.
Well, that announcement by the Chancellor puts greater focus on the need to secure a trade deal with the European Union, as we have been reporting, but time to agree a deal is fast running out. Now, another four migrants have drowned off the Spanish coast, trying to reach the shores of Europe. Dozens were rescued, some remain unaccounted for. The International Criminal Court has sued Europe, saying it allows deaths at sea as part of its deterrence-based migration policy. The bloc is trying to prevent migrants from setting out and reaching its shores, but it seems desperation is so acute, migrants are prepared to risk dying at sea and face heartbreaking conditions if they make it ashore.
Arrivals on the Canary Islands have surged. Almost 17,000 people have reached their shores so far this year, more than 10 times last year's total, and hundreds have died trying. The Spanish government has promised to set up camps and shelters for more than 7,000 people, but overwhelmed local authorities and activists say the migrants are being treated with contempt.
The majority of migrants who are arriving are returnable, or expellable, if we may say. They are not candidates that apply to our reception system. Our reception system is tailored for vulnerable people and people who have asked for international asylum.
Over in France, images of homeless migrants camped out on a Paris square being evacuated by police have caused outcry, forcing lawmakers to comment on the situation that seems far from under control.
Cette manifestation était-elle autorisée?
Was this event authorized? Was it legal? The answer is no. Should we have left on the Place de la République hundreds of tents, hundreds of people without evacuating them? The answer is no. Was I, like you or others, shocked to see some images on social media of evacuation? Proof that this is a free country? Of course.
Ceux qui n'ont rien, pas même à toi.
Those who have nothing, not even a roof over their heads, sheltered themselves symbolically under the statue symbolizing the Republic to call for fundamental rights. They were peaceful. The order was given for them to be evacuated at any cost, although they did not represent any threat at all.
Immigration to Europe is fueled by wars and economic instability in which Europe is complicit. The bloc's exploitation of resources and interventionism goes on around the globe, and countries like Britain sell arms to almost all regimes deemed violators of human rights. To stop migrants setting out in the first place, millions of euros are also pumped into countries like Libya, a conduit for African migrants, and end up in the hands of militiamen, traffickers and Coast Guard members who imprison and torture thousands of migrants. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The French Parliament has passed a controversial bill making it illegal to share images of law enforcement online for malicious purposes. It's called the Global Security Bill, introduced by two MPs from President Emmanuel Macron's centrist party. Its most controversial section, Article 24, has been censured by journalists and rights groups, who argue it infringes on journalists' freedom to report on public events and that it makes it harder to hold officers accountable. The offense would carry a prison sentence of up to 1 year and a maximum fine of 45,000 euros. Thousands of protesters took to the streets across the country over the weekend to denounce the new law. The bill will go to the French Senate in January for a second approval. The Russian Defense Ministry has released a video showing the country's peacekeepers securing a passage of vehicles in Nagorno-Karabakh's Lachin Corridor, a six-kilometer road connecting the region's territories populated by ethnic Armenians and Armenia. It also says it has set up 23 observation posts within the region and helped in the transport of food and medicine to the local towns and villages. Armenia and Azerbaijan fought a six-week bloody war over Nagorno-Karabakh starting on September 27th. The enclave is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but has a majority ethnic Armenian population. We kick this segment off with some breaking news. The Argentinian football icon Diego Maradona has passed away after a heart attack. And Ahmed Caballo joins me now to tell us what he knows about that legend. Ahmed?
Yeah, so the news has just come through, shocked many football fans around the world who remember Diego Maradona for his brilliant attributes and the way he played the beautiful game. The stuff that he did for Argentina, he won the World Cup, many people claim single-handedly. He took Napoli, a team in relegation, and won Serie A twice. But he's actually linked to our next story. Our next story is about military overseas bases networks around the world. And Diego Maradona was an anti-imperialist. He opposed Britain's war on the Falklands. And when he did his controversial Hand of God and was criticised in the British press, he said it was symbolic revenge for the war crimes by the Thatcher government at the time. He supported Fidel Castro and has actually died on the same day that Fidel Castro died a few years ago. And he also supported Venezuela when it was attacked by the United States and defended its right, its constitutionally elected president, Nicolas Maduro, and its constitutionally elected president before him, Hugo Chavez.
So he never left the public eye, so to speak, decades after he retired.
No, because he represented what somebody from the slums, somebody who would be considered on the outskirts of Argentinian society, and he made himself what many people argue is the greatest football player of all time. He could juggle with tomatoes, with oranges. He had immense skill, and he played the game as if it was just fun, and not as if it was a job. And many people will miss him, and many people are upset. It's one of the number one trending topics because of exactly what he did on a football pitch. But many people in Latin America also respect what he did off the football pitch and the politics that he represented. The downtrodden, the forgotten, the oppressed. He was always willing to stand up for them in the face of U.S. empire.
All right, more, of course, on the Argentine football legend in our broadcasts later today, Ahmed, but let's move on to your other story. This past week, the UK government announced its largest military investment since the Cold War, despite the coronavirus crisis battering the country's economy. Since then, a report by Declassified UK on the extent of the kingdom's global military presence. Give us the lowdown on that, Ahmed.
Yeah, so there's 145 sites in 42 countries, and it's extraordinary the scale of the UK's military overseas operations. And it has military bases in Oman, in Cyprus, the military base is used to refuel military special force operations in places like Syria. It has military bases in Iraq, despite the Iraqi parliament in January voting for all foreign troops to leave the country. And what's fascinating about this is whenever there were human rights abuses or some sort of massacre in these countries, there are still people from around the world that ask the UK to speak out. But when you look at this report by Declassified, it shows that the UK actually props up these regimes and supports them in suppressing their populations and their civilians. So in Oman, where it's a criminal offence to criticise the Sultan, Britain has military bases and provides training for the Oman special forces and the military forces. In Saudi Arabia, it provides support. It provides support in Bahrain, in the repression against protesters there. And controversially, it supports the Saudi-led war on Yemen by overseeing...
That, Ahmed, speaks to the hypocrisy of this government, because on one hand, They're sending a lot of aid to Yemen. They're a major, if not the major contributor of aid to Yemen. At the same time, the RAF is training pilots in Saudi to bomb those same Yemeni people, 25 million of whom, out of a population of 30 million, are facing food security, which is, in fact, a euphemism for famine.
Yeah, and it's our job to point out that hypocrisy. So the amount that they give in humanitarian aid is just a drop in the ocean compared to the billions upon billions that they make from selling the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, arms to bomb children, hospitals, and civilian infrastructure. And one of the people that's opposing this is Chris Williamson. He was a member of parliament for the Labour Party. He was kicked out for the Labour Party. And we can see why, because he was willing to speak out on things like this. He says, why on earth has the UK still got military bases overseas? An investigation by Declassified UK has revealed there are 145 of them in 42 countries. This isn't serving the national interest. It's an outrageous example of modern day imperialism. And Jaber says this, UK forces have 23 bases and personnel in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Persian Gulf states, and the US embassy in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. More controversial is Britain's major military base in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh. Armed forces are present in bases where RAF officers observe Saudi-led coalition air ops in Yemen.
All right, Ahmed, let's move on to your second story. And more on the clandestine meeting between the Israeli Prime Minister and the Saudi Crown Prince, known as MBS, and their so-called tactical alliance, which, looking at the story, is evidently got more to do with Iran than anything else, the thought of a Biden administration taking the United States back to the JCPOA, which is known as the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about this story is the Israelis initially tweeted that there was a secret meeting, and then that tweet was deleted, and now Netanyahu has refused to acknowledge that this secret meeting had taken place. The Saudis have completely refused to acknowledge it. But it clearly did, and it happens at a time for two strategically important reasons for both of these entities. For the Saudis, it's very clear that Joe Biden administration is going to be a lot more hostile towards them than the Donald Trump administration. Joe Biden has been very critical of the assassination of the Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He's also criticized the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Now, obviously, this is rhetoric. Whether he'll do anything in practice remains to be seen. And the Israelis clearly want to carry on with this attempt to get all these Arab regimes to normalize relations with Israel, and therefore forcing the Palestinians' hand, because all of their neighbors around them would have capitulated. But what's interesting about this story is we're finding out that the Saudis have been putting pressure on Pakistan, much like they've been putting pressure on Sudan. And it seems like the end game for the Saudi regime is, if it forces the other Arab nations to normalize relations with Israel first, then it can normalize relation, and its defense can be, well, we weren't the first, we were the last ones to do it. But it's clear they're the ones pulling the strings for these Muslim majority nations to normalize relations with Israel.
Right. How has this story gone down on social media, Ahmed?
Yes, yeah, so I'm going to go to a tweet, then I'm going to go to a VT. So I've got a tweet from Paxul. It says, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secretly visited Saudi Arabia, MBS, and has again proved that the Saudi dictator regime want to survive in power at any cost. There's much more to come. May Allah save us from the destruction that is going on towards the Muslim.
If we didn't have Saudi Arabia, we wouldn't have a big base. We wouldn't have any reason, probably. I mean, if you look at Israel, Israel would be in big trouble without Saudi Arabia. So what does that mean? Israel's going to leave? You want Israel to leave? We have a very strong ally in Saudi Arabia.
But any more reaction to that story?
Yes. So Ben Norton says the UK, US government, and the authoritarian proxy dictatorship props up Saudi, that he pops up in Saudi Arabia, is going around to every Muslim majority country and trying to bribe and threaten them to recognise apartheid Israel. Pakistan is the latest example. Not everyone agrees. We've got a Trump supporter, Prashant Patel. He says, Trump made Israeli-Saudi peace deal possible. Trump unravelled conflict with North Korea. Trump is the only US president who didn't start any war in the last 30 years. Still, Trump is hated by the far left. Now, I don't call it a peace deal. It's more like an anti-Iran war alliance. These countries have never, or these entities have never been a threat to one another. So it's not really a peace deal.
All right. Ahmed Caballo with those three stories. Ahmed, thank you very much. And that's all the time we have for this London broadcast, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you again soon.
Limelight. As President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election have steadily disintegrated, the country appears to have escaped a doomsday scenario in the campaign's epilogue. Since 3rd of November, there have been no tanks in the streets or widespread civil unrest in the US, no brazen intervention by the judiciary or a partisan state legislature. Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s obvious victory has withstood Donald Trump's peddling of conspiracy theories and his campaign of groundless lawsuits. Even in the absence of a questionable outcome or any evidence of fraud, President Trump has managed to freeze the passage of power for most of a month. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alexander Burns. The piece is titled, Trump stress-tested the election system and the cracks showed. Please stay with us for more of Alexander Burns' article. President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election have steadily disintegrated, the country appears to have escaped a doomsday scenario in the campaign's epilogue. Since 3rd of November, there have been no tanks on the streets or widespread civil unrest in the United States. There have been no brazen intervention by the judiciary or a partisan state legislature. Joseph Biden's obvious victory has withstood Donald Trump's peddling of conspiracy theories and his campaign of groundless lawsuits. In the end, and the post-election standoff instigated by Mr. Trump and his party is truly nearing its end, the president's attack on the election wheezed to an anticlimax. It was marked not by dangerous new political convulsions, but by a letter from an obscure Trump-appointed bureaucrat, Emily W. Murphy, of the General Services Administration, authorizing the process of formally handing over the government to Joe Biden. For now, the country appears to have avoided a ruinous breakdown of its electoral system. Next time, Americans might not be so lucky. While Donald Trump's mission to subvert the election has so far failed at every turn, it has nevertheless exposed deep cracks in the edifice of American democracy and opened the way for future disruption and perhaps future disaster. With the most amateurish of efforts, Donald Trump managed to freeze the passage of power for most of a month, commanding submissive indulgence from Republicans and stirring fear and frustration among Democrats as he explored a range of wild options for thwarting Joe Biden. he never came close to achieving his goal. Key state officials resisted his entreaties to disenfranchise huge numbers of American voters, and judges all but laughed his legal team out of court. Ben Ginsburg, the most prominent Republican election lawyer of his generation, said he doubted any future candidates would attempt to replicate Donald Trump's precise approach because it has been so unsuccessful. Few candidates and election lawyers, Mr. Ginsburg suggested, would regard Rudolph Giuliani and Sidney Powell, the public faces of Donald Trump's litigation, as the authors of an ingenious new playbook. If, in a few months, we look back and see this Trump strategy was just an utter failure, then it's not likely to be copied, said Mr. Ginsburg, who represented former President George W. Bush in the 2000 election standoff. But the system was stress-tested as never before. That test, he said, revealed enough vague provisions and holes in American election law to make crisis all too plausible. He pointed in particular to the lack of uniform standards for the timely certification of elections by state authorities, and the uncertainty about whether state legislators had the power to appoint their own electors in defiance of the popular vote. The 2020 presidential election, he said, should be a call for some consideration of these issues. Yet even without precipitating a full-blown constitutional crisis, Donald Trump has already shattered the long-standing norm that a defeated candidate should concede quickly and gracefully and avoid contesting the results for no good reason. He and his allies also rejected the long-standing convention that the news media should declare a winner, and instead exploiting the fragmentation of the media and the rise of platforms like Twitter and Facebook to encourage an alternative reality experience for his supporters. The next Republican candidate to lose a close election may find some voters expecting him or her to mimic Donald Trump's conduct, and if a Democrat were to adopt the same tactics, the GOP would have no standing to complain. Still more important, legal and political experts said, is the way Donald Trump identified perilous pressure points within the system. Those vulnerabilities, they said, could be manipulated to destabilizing effect by someone else in a closer election, perhaps one that featured real evidence of tampering or foreign interference, or an outcome that delivers a winner who was beaten handily in the popular vote but scored a razor-thin margin of victory in the Electoral College. In those scenarios, it might not be such a long-shot gambit for a losing candidate to attempt to halt certification of election results through low-profile state and county boards, or to bestir state legislators to appoint a slate of electors, or to pressure political appointees in the federal government to block a presidential transition. Indeed, Donald Trump managed to intrude on normal election procedures in several states. He summoned Michigan Republican leaders to the Oval Office, as his allies floated the idea of appointing pro-Trump electors from the state, which Joe Biden carried by more than 150,000 votes. And he inspired an onslaught from the right against Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who declined to affirm Donald Trump's false claims of ballot tampering. Though Mr. Raffensperger oversaw a fair election, both of Georgia's Republican senators, channeling the president, called for his resignation. Michael Lee, senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, said the country had experienced a Lord of Flies moment that revealed just how willing some power actors were to enable an undisguised effort to sabotage a free and fair election. It's easy to laugh at the Trump challengers just because they've been so out there, Mr. Lee said. But what's scary is you step back from that a bit and see how many people were willing to go along with it until fairly deep in the process. There will be closer elections ultimately, he added. This one wasn't very close. The fact that people are willing to go down dangerous paths should give us all pause. It remains to be seen whether Donald Trump will wind up as a singularly sore loser or as the herald of a new Wild West era in American electioneering. There have been far closer elections in this century, including the 2000 vote that plunged the country into a week-long review of Florida's rickety vote counting procedures, and the 2016 election that made Donald Trump president, though a historically wide split between the popular vote and the Electoral College. But no one else has entertained the corrosive tactics Donald Trump has sought to employ. Like numerous other presidential schemes over the past 4 years, Mr. Trump's plot against the election unraveled in part because of external circumstances, the large number of swing states Joe Biden carried, for instance, and in part because of his own clumsiness. His lawyers and political advisors never devised an actual strategy for reversing the popular vote in multiple big states, relying on a combination of televised chest thumping and wild claims of big city election fraud for which there was no evidence. Barbara Pariente, the former Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court who oversaw the state-level battle over the 2000 vote, said it was essential for Congress to clarify the process by which elections are conducted and resolved for risk greater calamity in the coming years. Donald Trump's team, she said, had already breached fundamental standards of legal conduct by filing cases seeking to throw out huge numbers of voters without any evidence of impropriety, and then asking a court to look further into it. As I look at what is happening now, I think it's a real attack on our American system of democracy, and it is causing tens of millions of Americans to doubt the outcome, Ms. Pariente said. It has grave implications, in my view, for the future of this country. Even if Congress were to impose a clearer set of election procedures, however, there is reason to doubt whether the rules could reverse the total war mindset that Donald Trump has modeled. In failure, he has created a roadmap for his own party, or even, under certain circumstances, for a grievance-laden Democrat to wage a bitter-end fight against an unfavorable election result, with the support of loud voices in the right-wing media and much of his party's conservative base. And it is that last cohort, the millions of voters who remain loyal to Donald Trump and who appear largely indifferent to the fact of the vote tally and the niceties of legal procedure, that represents the most potent kind of weapon for this defeated president or another executive who might follow his example. Sean Rosenberg, a professor of political and psychological science at the University of California at Irvine, who has written pessimistically about the trajectory of American democracy, said Donald Trump has been highly effective at exploiting the gap between the complexity of the country's political system and the more rudimentary grasp most voters have of their government. For the average partisan, he said, issues of political norms and procedures were very abstract and far less important than simply winning, an impulse Mr. Trump stoked to the detriment of democratic institutions. Rosenberg warned that while Donald Trump's political opposition had managed to unseat an incumbent, a rare feat in the nation's presidential system, the election was not the kind of overwhelming rout that might have proven American democracy invulnerable to the kind of erosion on display in newer democracies like Poland and India. That was something of a disappointment for Mr. Trump's critics on both the left and the right, he said. Their hope was that he had gone so far that he would awaken his awareness and resolve in the American people, Mr. Rosenberg said, and clearly that was not the case for roughly 74 million Americans.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has lashed out at Britain, France, and Germany for their stance on Tehran's missile program. Speaking in a meeting with the heads of the country's three branches of the government, Ayatollah Khamenei warned the Iranian officials that the three European countries cannot be trusted. The leader also slammed these countries for complicity with the United States in putting the Iranian nation under the pressure of sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei said the issue of sanctions is a bitter reality and a crime committed by the U.S. and its European partners against the Iranian nation. He also noted that this crime is not new and has been committed against the Iranians for years, but it has intensified over the past 3 years. Ayatollah Khamenei urged people to continue their resistance against such measures. Iran's leader remarks came a day after top French, British, and German diplomats met in Berlin to discuss a joint approach with the incoming administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden on reviving the Iranian nuclear deal. The three European countries also issued a joint condemnation of what they called Iran's latest breaches, including the use of more advanced centrifuges. This as Tehran has itself been critical of the European signatories to the nuclear deal for not abiding by their obligations following the unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the agreement in May 2018. Tehran says the European countries have failed to make up for Washington's reimposition of sanctions. Many believe the European governments lack the political will to counter U.S. measures against the 2015 nuclear agreement.
Regardless of the good cop, bad cop, Jekyll and Hyde game, which is what we've seen between Washington and EU, I think our European colleagues, there's a lack of political will when it comes to Iran. They've been engaging when it comes to the Iranian nuclear accord. In practice, we have been witnessing a lack of political will, like I said, as well as the economic leverage that the Europeans seem to not have over Washington.
The Islamic Republic has also criticized the European parties' inaction on U.S. measures following its withdrawal, while Tehran remained committed to the pact. Tehran argues that its retaliatory measures are in accordance with the terms of the JCPOA. To show its goodwill, Iran has also said it will undo its commitment rollbacks only if the European signatories honor their commitments. Iran says the E3 needs to restore balance to the landmark accord by working to lift sanctions against Tehran. What has left the Iran nuclear deal in jeopardy is indisputably the U.S. pullout in the first place and lack of valor on the part of the Europeans not to get in line with U.S. hostile approaches toward Tehran. However, one should be skeptical to see if the coming U.S. administration can bring anything tangible to save the agreement.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday.